This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up. Luke Davidsi, chairman of the Zimbabwe Immigration Federation, says a court decision to postpone for a year South Africa's efforts to send migrants from its neighboring country home is a bad decision. Also, a British court rules that a government plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful, and EU leaders are meeting to discuss aid to Tunisia in a bid to slow the departure of migrant boats for Europe. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. A Sudanese psychologist and trauma specialist says sexual violence has been rampant in Sudan's conflict, which is in its third month now. Suleyma Ishak is also the director of Combating Violence Against Women, a unit within Sudan's Ministry of Social Development. She tells VOA's Nabil Biajo that young women, immigrant and refugee women, as well as women from African ethnicities, have been particularly targeted. While her unit has documented more than 60 cases of rape and sexual violence, Ishak says that's only a fraction of the actual number.
What we are saying in numbers, it represents only 2% of what's really happening. Because when it comes to gender-based violence and sexual violence related to conflict, we consider all women are located in the zones where conflict are. They are subjected to this kind of violence. Especially that we are talking not just about Khartoum and Darfur. We are also including the three Kordofans. So it's like 9 states are still are in the vast danger of sexual violence related to conflicts inflicted upon them. On our recent update, we have 61 cases. I had that happens in Khartoum, which is 36 in Khartoum and 25 in South Darfur. But actually, we have numbers of what happened in West Darfur, and that's have been coming very much late because during the attacks on West Darfur, we don't have any kind of connection to the people. Most of our connections are restored after people have already moved to Chad. It's in Khartoum, all women are targeted, but mostly you find that little girls from the age of 12 to 16, 18, they are mostly targeted, especially when they're coming from African ethnicity. You see those people who are residing in under construction buildings within rich neighborhood, or they are just coming from impoverished families. They always been targeted. And even eyewitnesses could confirm there was the videotape that we provided for CNN. It was taped within the area where we protections committee cannot reach out for victims because mostly they are coming from very poor family. They're children, and they when they are even approached by helpers, they just run away because they are they have been very scared.
Besides age, the age groups these victims fall under. There are also reports that that refugee women, immigrants,
refugee women, Ethiopia, immigrants
from South Sudan.
Yes, and even African ethnicity in Sudan, the Sudanese African ethnicity, and people who are affiliated more into African ethnicity, they are all targeted. Like houses of refugees in Khartoum and Omdurman and Bahri had been actually attacked, and people have and remove themselves afterwards. That's those attacks. We don't know where they go. The first victims were also Ethiopian and refugees. There's also other nationalities involved sometimes. It will come in our reports. And women from South Sudan as well.
With the ongoing fighting and many hospitals being out of service and aid organizations unable to move around freely, where do victims of rape and sexual violence find help?
Okay, there's very few hospitals around Khartoum. Doctors who moved around from this hospital, actually they're doing it in the impossible way. Like they're moving from one hospital to another. They're trying to provide support as the minimum standard. Sometimes even victims cannot move out of their houses or premises, so they just prescribe the medications to them. And the medication is only the minimum standard. Like instead of the one pill that's used to prevent pregnancy, they are using contraceptives with certain dosage for each age. And then they are using antibiotics to stop transmitting of sexually transmitted diseases. But the antivirals, the other part of the protocol is not available because the medical supplies, building is fully under the control of RSF. There's enough supplies stored over there, but they cannot receive them. So they are trying to get medications even from Medani or other ways. This is the situation. It's just providing the minimum standard, not more of that.
That's Suleyma Ishak, a Sudanese psychologist and trauma specialist. She is also director of Combating Violence Against Women, a department within Sudan's Ministry of Social Development. She was speaking with Nabil Biagio from Sudan earlier today. The U.S. Agency for International Development says it is horrified by the ongoing suffering experienced by the people of Ethiopia. In an email to the Associated Press, the humanitarian agency said it will focus on resuming food assistance as soon as possible once officials can be sure it reaches the designated people in need. The statement comes after the U.S. and the United Nations paused food assistance in early June over the massive theft of aid intended to go to the northern Tigray region. USAID called the suspension wrenching and a measure of last resort because of, quote, the extreme scale and coordination of food aid diversion identified across the country, end quote. It says over 700 starvation-related deaths have been recorded since the pause started. Aid workers say Ethiopian government officials who are involved in the aid delivery process were involved in the theft, a charge authorities deny. A two-year war between Tigray and the federal government ended in November. The conflict, as well as drought conditions, have led to about 20 million people across the country needing food assistance. A British court ruled today that a government plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful, delivering a blow to the Conservative administration's pledge to stop migrants making risky journeys across the English Channel. Paul Ndiho has more.
In that sense, Rwanda is not a safe third country. That conclusion is founded on the evidence which was before the High Court that Rwanda's system for deciding asylum claims was, in the period up to the conclusion of the Rwanda agreement, inadequate. The court is unanimous in accepting that the assurances given by the Rwandan government were made in good faith and were intended to address any defects in the asylum process. However, the majority believes that the evidence does not establish that the necessary changes had by then been reliably effected, or would have been at the time of the proposed removals. In consequence, sending anyone to Rwanda would constitute a breach of Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which Parliament has required the government to comply with.
That is Lord Burnett, the Lord Chief Justice, speaking during a session of the Court of Appeal today. He said there is a risk that persons sent to Rwanda will be returned to their home countries where they face persecution or other inhumane treatment, even if they have valid asylum claims. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said he fundamentally disagrees with the Court of Appeal's ruling, and his government will appeal to the Supreme Court. Earlier this month, he pledged to stop the boats, a reference to the overcrowded vessels that make the journey from northern France carrying migrants who hope to live in the UK. The Rwandan government also took issue with the ruling, saying Rwanda is one of the safest countries in the world. The UK and Rwandan governments agreed more than a year ago that some migrants who arrive in Britain as stowaways or in small boats would be sent to Rwanda, where their asylum claims would be processed. But a European Court of Human Rights ruling blocked that plan last June. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these stories and others from the continent, head on over to Africa, voaafrica.com, and there you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. European Union leaders are meeting today to discuss aid to Tunisia in an effort to slow the departure of migrant boats headed to Europe. The French news agency AFP reports that European Council Chief Charles Michel said leaders at the Brussels summit will discuss implementing decisions made at a meeting in February. Those decisions include an offer by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen of more than 1 billion euros, that's about $1.1 billion, if Tunis meets International Monetary Fund conditions for a loan worth nearly $2 billion. The EU money would go to improving economic prospects for people in Tunisia. An additional 100 million euros this year would go to boosting Tunisia's border patrols and accepting back denied asylum seekers. Also under discussion is a plan to have EU members share the burden of hosting asylum seekers, either by taking in migrants or helping fund the cost in other countries. Poland and Hungary are strongly against that move. The International Organization for Migration says nearly 1,200 migrants have died or disappeared crossing the Mediterranean so far this year. In Rutshuru territory in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, students are not able to take state exams due to the presence of M23 rebels occupying part of the area. The exams are scheduled to be held throughout the country from June 26th to the 29th. The local cancellation of the tests comes after 2 years of disruption in education. Our reporter in Goma, Zanem Neti Zaidi, has details.
Before the fighting broke out, Andres Sadiki was a finalist or a bachelor's degree candidate in general pedagogy in Rutshuru territory. He is currently in Kiwanja looking for a job until school resumes. He does not understand why the authorities are not saying anything about the fate of candidates like him in Rutshuru territory. He says at this moment he should be sitting for the state exam, but because of the war here at home in North Kivu, they have not been able to do so in Rutshuru and Kiwanja. He says even the president does not talk about them missing the exams. They are told nothing. They are given no reassurance that next year they will be able to take the test again. This situation affects high school students in the region who risk losing a year of study. To avoid this, parents are asking the government to organize a special catch-up session. Yvette Katungu does not want to see her child repeat a year. She says she is surprised to see that exams are being taken elsewhere, while here they do not even study. It is really sad for them as parents because their children are no longer young enough to resume the school year. She hopes that the authorities will find a solution so that their children can take the state exam. At this stage, the authorities have taken no decision about the fate of pupils in Rutshuru territory. Jonas Mumbe, the head of a school in Kiwanja, believes that the education system is in peril. He says, so far, the government has not communicated. They are in the M23 occupied zone, so they do not know if they will have a special exam or what will be done for them. As for the children, they have lost almost 2 years of schooling because last year they had little time in the classroom. The consequence is the loss of education. Children's rights organizations such as UNICEF have called for the resumption of school activities in areas under M23 control, but to date, schools remain closed. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Neti Zaidi in Goma.
In Zimbabwe, dairy farmers and the dairy industry are collaborating with the government to reduce the carbon footprint in the sector while still ensuring that the demand for milk is satisfied. Many experts say livestock farming is one of the sectors that contributes the most to global warming. Reporter Kudzinai Misengi brings us more.
46-year-old Agnes Kwenda has a dairy farm on the outskirts of Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second biggest city. In 2019, she had 4 cows, from which she was getting about 60 liters of milk daily. But her herd has now grown to 47 cows, and she now produces nearly 4 times more milk. Kwenda says she is aware of the global concerns that livestock farming is a heavy contributor to global warming. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 14.5% of all human-derived emissions come from livestock through the gas they emit and through the cost of producing feed and transporting animals. Kwenda, however, says dairy farming can be done in a sustainable way that helps reduce its carbon footprint considerably. For instance, the waste can be used as biogas or as fertilizer that is similar to one known as Compound D.
My guys don't cut trees to produce fuel that they need for cooking. We use the same dung. And that same dung is the Compound D that is now made in a factory that is producing emissions. I'm just taking it from the bioslurry into the fields. And I'm enhancing the soil. The soil here was terrible before we started. Now it's amazing. So I think that dairy farming is very sustainable.
Tendai Marecha is the Secretary General for the Dairy Processors Association of Zimbabwe. She says the organization focuses on supporting every level of the dairy value chain, from the farm to the factory, to improve productivity and efficiency and helping reduce emissions from the sector as a whole. Added to the collaboration with farmers and government, Marecha says the industry is pooling resources to aid in transportation.
We do collective transportation. The logistics is organized for the sector. So you don't need each one bringing in their own thing. And bringing things together in one truck is reducing the number of trucks that we use for transportation or logistics in the milk value chain.
Admo Waniwa is the chief dairy officer at the Ministry of Agriculture. He says Zimbabwe has 47,000 dairy cows and produced 91 million liters of milk in 2022. The country consumes 130 million liters of milk a year, so it imports the rest that is needed. Waniwa says the government is working with farmers in the dairy industry to improve breeds to get more milk from fewer cows.
We are having to import animals from South Africa, but what government is also looking at in the long term is trying to capacitate our local breeders. There are programs that are aimed at breeding, which government has initiated. One is such is the establishment of bull centers, where there is collection of semen from dairy bulls, which is processed and then that can be used for artificial insemination by farmers.
Zimbabwe is a member of the East and Southern Africa Dairy Association as well as the International Dairy Federation. It also is a signatory to the Rotterdam Dairy Declaration, which aspires to work within the framework of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, including combating climate change and eradicating hunger and gender inequity. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Msengi.
At the site of one of the world's biggest slave ports, a museum designed to simultaneously hold the sensations of both trauma and joy, opened this week. It honors the many thousands of Africans forced to leave home under barbaric conditions. It also celebrates their American legacy. The International African American Museum opened Tuesday at Gadsden's Wharf in Charleston, South Carolina, where more than 40% of enslaved Africans came to U.S. shores. Columbia University professor of history Christopher Brown explains to me why this museum opened at Gadsden's Wharf in the southern U.S. city of Charleston.
Charleston was, in some ways, the Ellis Island for Africans brought to what became the United States in the 18th and early 19th century. I mean, close to half of enslaved Africans who came directly from Africa passed through Charleston. And Gadsden's Wharf was one of those places where slave ships unloaded their, you know, their human cargo. So, you know, it really is a significant place as far as the gateway to slavery for so many African people who came to what became the United States. So it's very appropriate that has been established in Charleston in that particular location.
The museum includes an ancestry research center. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's an exciting move for these kinds of museums to really take seriously the Africanness, the African background of enslaved men and women. You know, a history which is often, you know, deeply obscured or romanticized and generalized in ways that don't provide much in the way of cultural specificity. The work that's gone on in the Atlantic slave trade over the last half century has really allowed scholars to know much more about where people came from, when they arrived, where they departed from in Africa. You know, that resource at the museum is going to galvanize, I think, you know, investigations into the individual backgrounds of men, women, and children who arrived. I mean, there's no registers of individuals. There's no sort of census that was taken at the time of people asking, you know, who are you? Where are you from? What's your name? How old are you? That kind of information, which occurs in other sort of migration registers for other people, is just not, it's never kept, was never made at the time. But there's a lot more information out there than scholars have realized, and I think the museum is going to facilitate those kinds of investigations.
You know, in the books that I've read, the way it worked was when they were sold, the people just, they lost their last names, they lost, you know, their family too. Some, many of them were separated from their siblings or even their children. So this has got to be a lot harder than, say, you know, Europeans who came over and went through Ellis Island.
That's right. And it's, you know, it also happened at the point of purchase on the West African side. You know, the European merchants who sailed up into West African waters had no interests in the names of the people who they were acquiring. They had no interest in their cultural affiliations, their national affiliations. You know, what they were doing was purchasing men, women, and children who, from the standpoint of the slave purchasers, you know, were just cargo, were anonymous people who could just be, you know, traded as commodities. And so when people reach Charleston, you know, those connections are just further obscured.
A lot of people must have died either on the boat coming over or at the wharf.
Yes, yes. Over the course of the Atlantic slave trade, it varies from between 10% to 20% of folks who perished during the crossing. Obviously, on individual ships, it could be much greater than that or perhaps a little bit less than that. But, you know, in most instances, those who did survive arrived quite sick, dehydrated, famished, beaten and bruised, not to mention severely dispirited by what had happened and what was happening to them.
Aside from trying to help people connect with their relatives and their ancestors, is it also meant to let people try to understand what their culture was before they came here, being forced into slavery?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, for many African Americans and people who are not African American, but curious about the history of Black culture and Black life, you know, the question of where have we come from and what was lost in the passage is something that has always been a very powerful question and set of concerns. And, you know, a museum like this, I think, further makes possible the inquiries, provides some answers for those, for that curiosity.
That is Christopher Brown. He's professor of history at Columbia University. He was speaking to me yesterday from New York City. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabro, and our engineer, Atreus Regis, thanks for choosing, that is, the Voice of America.
Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.